So we can get this kicked off. So good morning, everyone. My name is Asia Stewart, and I am a recent graduate from the University of Cambridge, where I completed my master's degree in the sociology of marginality and exclusion. And I'm actually in New York right now, so it's a real pleasure to be joining you all today from across the pond here. So I just want to kick things off by setting the terms of decorum for our session together. I'm just going to be sharing this slide with you in one moment. Let's see here. So you all should be able to see this now on your screen.
Yep.
So also as a disclaimer before we begin, that this session is going to be recorded and distributed to those who couldn't physically or virtually join us at this time. So now just to go over some etiquette and overview of the session. So after my brief introduction on the topic of work and the overview of the session, we'll be hearing from our two speakers, Mr. Paul Davidson and Mr. Paul Abina, who I will be introducing momentarily. Each speaker will be allotted 15 minutes to give their presentation and respond to a series of questions that I've personally drafted for them. As each speaker presents, I highly encourage you to make note of any questions that you'd like to ask them. After both speakers have presented, we will begin a Q&A session during the final 15 minutes of our time together. As you develop questions, please message them to me through the chat function in Zoom. That way, I can make sure that we touch on as many of them as possible. Lastly, I ask that you keep your microphones muted throughout the course of our time together so that we can all easily hear and listen to both of our speakers. If you have any questions or concerns throughout any point of the session, please feel free to contact me. So now you may be wondering, why are we here today discussing work and the economy and employment? We're all well aware that the labor market in the UK both engenders and perpetuates forms of racial inequality. Black people in the UK face limited employment prospects and suffer from higher rates of unemployment and underemployment, despite possessing a multitude of qualifications and talents. In fact, the unemployment rate of Black British people is more than double the unemployment rate of their white counterparts. As a growing number of individuals are party to zero-hour contracts and participate in the gig economy, those who are employed are afforded fewer protections by their employers. Most financial institutions, companies, and corporations in the UK have directly profited from the labor of Black and Brown people, but have offered them less than the bare minimum in return as recompense. Such conditions have only been exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. BME individuals are also underrepresented in most sectors, whose workplaces are predominantly white. Within these spaces, BME people are rarely given opportunities for promotion and salary raises, but forced to carry the burden of making their offices and companies appear to be more quote unquote diverse and inclusive. At the same time, austerity measures and welfare cuts have eroded the social safety net, making it increasingly difficult for individuals in need to access public services or assistance. These challenges only compound when factors such as one's immigration status, gender, and sexuality are taken into account. These barriers limit the possibility of social mobility and deny BME people access to the capital necessary to make long-term investments and avoid housing and job insecurity. In the face of many of these challenges, we are tasked today to consider how we can subvert and operate outside of oppressive systems of power that keep Black British people financially entrapped. The two main questions that we will be addressing today are, one, how can we use legal mechanisms to address racial disparities that exist in the labor market? And two, how can we as a community take further action to eradicate these disparities outside of any legislative framework? I've additionally drafted some additional questions for us to consider, not only during the session, but as we move through the world later today. So third, how can we as a community support existing Black businesses and entrepreneurs and spur the creation of new ones? Four, how do we address racial and ethnic pay gaps? Five, denied the ability to procure property in the UK, how should members of the Black British community take steps to acquire physical space? Six, to what extent can financial independence be utilized as a tool of liberation? Seven, interactions with officials at job centers, social services, and housing offices are often dehumanizing and disempowering. Given the fact that the state ignores and neglects forms of Black suffering in particular, how can members of the Black British community provide for ourselves? And lastly, due to COVID-19, Black British citizens who were struggling financially prior to the onset of the pandemic are facing new threats of economic precarity. What steps can we take as a community to care for ourselves when and where the government fails to? So I know that there is absolutely no way we'll be able to touch on all of those questions today, but I do hope that there are things that you continue to consider and ruminate over as we go forward. So now it is my great pleasure to introduce the two speakers that we are very lucky to be joined by today. So today we have Mr. Paul Davidson and Mr. Paul Obino with us. Paul Davidson is one of the directors of Thank You for Doing Something About It, or TIVESDAI, African Diaspora Business Acquisition Club Limited. His nonprofit company is focused on developing the power of the Black Pound and encouraging Black business, entrepreneurship, and community development through the development of a Black economic platform. Paul is also the director of the Fresh Start Independence Project, which provides housing, support, and training for young people in Manchester who require it. Today, Mr. Davidson will be speaking on a presentation entitled Creating Jobs Through Financing Small Businesses. After Mr. Davidson, we will hear from Mr. Paul Obina. Paul Obina was born in 1959 of Igbo and English parentage in Preston, UK. To better understand the historical relationship between these African and European worlds, he designed the lineage timeline, displaying a 9,000-year continuum to expand the viewer's comprehension of both history, past the contentious periods of Arab and European colonization and slavery, and history. This information is vital at what Paul terms the lineage interface in any workplace where this extended sense of history is used to lay the foundation of becoming fully, quote, PC, meaning personal confidence and professional competence. So it is my pleasure to now turn the session over to Mr. Paul Davidson, who will be walking us through his presentation now.
Thank you very much, Aisha. I would have thought, though, I was really looking forward to hearing Paul speak before me, just simply because he deals with the journey that we've been on, mm-hmm. and I'm very focused on the journey ahead of us.
I mean,
do you want to switch it around?
Sure.
I think it might be a bit, because I'm going to respond to some of the things that you're going to mention, Paul.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to share screen then. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
Host disabled attendee from sharing. So you need to give me the access.
Okay. I think you should have access now.
Okay, let me see this here. Share screen. Boom. Yes, here I am. Share. Okay. And then I shall go start from here. Are we okay? You can see that?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation. I was talking to my recruiter, Jerome, and I said I was so pleased that I've just entered the stage of senior eldership. I'm 61 years old, and Jerome's about 23 years old. So when I hear youngsters doing things, it makes me feel really good that as I'm closer to death than I am to my birth. So I feel really good that there's people coming through with a level of understanding and who are doing, you know, great things, getting the qualifications, moving into the work framework. You're going to be the ones who are going to be the leaders. So it's fantastic for me to know that I can leave without feeling that bad. I've contributed and I can then move on. So I put down here Windrush Day. The reason being, I'm not surprised at the situation facing the Black community in the UK. I was actually raised in a town called Blackburn in Lancashire. I always say it's a good name for the town. And because I was adopted into a white family I was born in 59. So I went through the 1960s and the 70s and 80s with absolutely zero backing from a family structure even. So I had to be, well, I didn't have to become, but I did become a fighter. I found that defending myself by any means necessary was a very practical thing to do. But I was like a flypaper to information and knowledge to make me understand why it was I was facing the kind of persecution I was. My first day in school, which was Wednesday, April 3rd, 1963, ironically the same day as the Birmingham, Alabama riots or uprisings. My first day, my first playtime, I was threatened to be stabbed with a petty knife, the boy called it, because I went up the slide in front of him. So I was the only child of color in my schooling until the age of 11. And so I learned a very kind of individualistic self-protection kind of background. That's what I developed. And so with that, knowledge, of course, became a key thing. When I asked my mom when I got home, my adopted mom at that stage, I said, what's a black bastard? But I didn't understand. And as you can see, I'm light skinned. I was darker back then because I'm out in the sun all the time. But when I asked her, she said, you're not black, you're golden brown. I go, okay. So this is a 1960s European lady raising me. And then, but then she said these words, she said, you're half English and you're half African. So after that point at 4 years old, if you call me black, I fight you. If you call me African, we're cool. Does that make sense? But then when I met Caribbean people who were ashamed of their African heritage, I couldn't get it. I didn't understand. So I started moving in the black community when I was 16 years old, and I couldn't understand it. But what I knew was that there was a deep psychological game. And so from that, I had to understand, how does that damaged psychology move in and appear confident and competent in the white world, in the European world? So I knew I had my reality, but I had to go and study. And so I got into a thing called psychohistory, psychology and history combined. I found out later it was a French discipline, sociology discipline, but I didn't know it back then. I just started combining these things of history and psychology. So let me get on with this. Burning work. Let me go to the start. The Dr. Malefi Asante, who's out of Philadelphia, Temple University, he says that there's a twin pillars of consciousness. There's consciousness towards oppression and consciousness towards victory. Overwhelmingly, we get hit with these things of poverty versus health. We have violence versus peace, lack versus abundance, disease versus health, misery versus happiness, and failure versus success. So I always ask people, which of these are generally portrayed as or nurtured as being black? What we've got now is Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. I've heard white people say, well, you were given freedom, you were given independence. But the word independence does not mean freedom. When you're independent, it means you're free to act within the constraints placed by those who are holding the strings. So it says independence, you're dependent on the people that's there. So we're still dependent, you're not free. We're still dependent on those. And then constantly consciousness towards oppression is being nurtured by television shows, by films, all that there is. I always call it the lack in black. Take the B off black, it says lack. Every time you recite the term black, you're saying the word lack. And lack self-love, lack self-knowledge, lack self-respect, etc. What happened was, I was once asked to come and do some work. I'm a big believer in demarcation between what I call agenda A and agenda B. Agenda A is professional, agenda B is personal. I tend not to mix the two. I can see personable in the workplace when I'm working. However, I'm clear agenda A is what I'm about. I've got to be clear on what I'm doing there. Once I was asked to work at Warwick University with a group of NHS, National Health Service managers who had just failed to get to the senior management mark. Very, very, so they were gathered together. And I was asked by the other facilitator, can you do something to explore their consciousness towards the how they feel about themselves? I said, okay, I'm a bit of a rascal. I'll find something to do. So what we did, on the morning they arrived, we set up a video camera in a room, and then he did a meet and greet, asked them who they were, their name, and then my job was to explore. And so we did this. There was one Frenchman. There were around about eight Asian guys. By Asian Asia, we mean from India, Indian descent, Pakistan, etc. And then there were around about 12 African descent of Caribbean and continental origin. So when they came in, they were asked, and so the guy said, he said, who are you? We give your name, address, not address, but who you work for, etc. Then they said, my colleague Paul would like to talk to you. And I said to them, I'm meeting you, we're having a work meeting, but I'm meeting you at London Bridge Station. I have no camera phone. I want to know who I'm looking for. Could you please describe yourself for me? The Frenchman said, oh, I'm a Frenchman. I am white. I am 5'10". I am, you know, a medium build, you know, something about, okay. All the Asian people said, oh yes, I'm Asian man, Asian woman. Hi, I'm wearing these clothes. I'm doing whatever. None of the African people mentioned their color. Not one of them. Oh, sorry. One did. One of the women, and she said, I'm a bubbly black woman. So she had to put a behavior in front of her color. And so what we then did, I said, okay. So we just recorded this. Then we went to work on what we call the 5 C's of awareness. It's devised by Dr. Owick Johnson and Patty DeRosa. You can see, I'll leave this on here, the change works. You can see the full 10 C's model. But what happened was, we moved through the 5 C's. So we have the color, culture, class, character, and finally context. And this is a framework that I was working with and developing them so that they could become PC, personally confident, professionally competent. At the end of the 2 days, let me just go through this first. Color, used symbolically two ways. Firstly, race. The first thing you see, in all my life, forgive my language, I have never been called a bastard black. I was always called a black bastard. If you see what I say, color is the first thing you see, even before gender, they'll log that in. So color was the first thing. Secondly, they use it symbolically as aspects of the self you cannot change naturally. So that would be sexual orientation, gender, etc., etc. So it's used literally and symbolically. Secondly, culture, the way you do what you do. Just because you have a certain color don't mean to say you have the same culture. So you have a person from Nigeria, a person from Jamaica, they may have similarities, but there'll be intrinsic differences in spoken language, or it may be in foods, or it may be in beliefs or whatever. So culture, the way you do what you do. So because you have a culture, don't expect them to have the same, sorry, color, just don't expect them to have the same culture. You can share color and culture, but be from a different class background. For instance, my ex-wife and her friends were upper middle class Nigerians. They ain't dealing with street incidents with the police, for instance. They turn around and say, I'm contacting my lawyer. There'll be a legal framework that they would use and apply even on those circumstances. So you can share color and culture, be a different class. You can share color, culture, class, be a totally different character. So for instance, you may have some black people are accommodating and would, you know, try and laugh things off or whatever. Or you meet someone like me when I was a young man who would fight you. And, you know, I'd be one of those embarrassing guys who would be up front. So I'm more Malcolm X than I am Martin Luther King, if you see what I'm saying. So my method of protection is different. So I'd be more upfront with what I did. Then finally, context. I know people who have to leave their color, culture, class, and their character at the entrance to the workplace. And they mind their P's and Q's because they have a massive discomfort about being in the context. Let me just show you here with the interface model that what happens is, the interface model, we have agenda A, professional, agenda B, personal. What happens is personal one will come into the interface, bringing with them their history and their cultural capital. If your cultural capital is based on enslavement or colonization, if all you've ever been taught about yourself is that the best you can be is Christian, Muslim, or some other design that's been invented by someone else, not you, it means you're going to be dependent on other people for your sense of self. And what that is a devastating thing to do, especially when you're coming in, your cultural capital, therefore, is extremely weak. The shortest history on the planet, those who've been colonized. Second shortest, those who've been enslaved. And that means you're the youngest person on the planet, rather than them with the longest lineage, with the longest history, etc. So what happens is this: you bring in your color, culture, class, character into the context. That will give you a sense of status about how you feel about yourself. But guess what? Person B is going to come in. They too are going to bring their sense of history and cultural capital, and they're going to bring their color, culture, class, character into the context, and they too will have a sense of status. Please remember this: we don't call it white history, we call it history. We don't call it white psychology, we call it psychology. We don't call it white sociology, we call it sociology. They are central, and that's their way, and that's how happy they want it to stay. So what happens is everybody else has to play women's history or black history, or China, everything. There's a universalization of the European thought and opinion, and that's what's going on all of the time. That's what's being nurtured in our consciousness. There's another thing here called lineage, which I'll go in another time, which is going to go. I want to just show you the kayak story. This is the work of Dr. Kerry Spackman, and what he says in his book, The Winner's Bible, that if you have agenda A, agenda B, and you've got the professional and personal levels, he tells the story of the kayak race. He challenged his friend, who was an Olympic gold medalist, big bronze, blonde beach type, massive, how to a kayak race. He did it in front of all of his friends. And what happened was, he said, I'm going to beat you. And they're going, mate, you can't do that. He said, this guy's going to kill you. And he went, okay, no, I'm going to. So he fronted it. So what did they have? They have a kayak. If you notice with the kayak, that the intention that he had was to win on agenda A. They were having a race. But beneath the surface, we have this. It's the rudder of the kayak. What Kerry Spackman had done, his friend's kayak, he'd shifted the rudder to the side. So when they went, on your marks, get set, go, and they start kayaking, the Olympic champion's kayak is spinning in a circle. He can't make forward purchase. Dr. Kerry's going forward and he wins the race. Why? Because his agenda B is personal, is aligned with his agenda A. When I talked to the people on the second day of the training, and we went through this thing, I said, do you feel better about yourself? And I said, do you understand this thing about being in context with your true self, your authentic self, feeling good about you, not getting angry or whatever, just feeling confident and competent? Yes, you do. I said, brilliant, because yesterday when I asked you about who you were, you didn't mention your color. Yes, we did. I said, no, you didn't. No, yeah, we did, whatever. I said, roll camera, action. And they were, oh my God. And they didn't even think. They were on agenda A. Their color didn't count. And if you don't have that thing without before anybody else, you can sit down and pray in church with a person from another culture, another thing, all praying to the same God, but then that person is going out to a different world, a different environment, because the context belongs to them, or their culture carries them there, and they have that sense of self. So let me just finish with this. This is the lineage timeline depicting a longer now, I've got about 20 seconds. What I want to do is just give you, this is the idea here. If you see my arrow, let me go back one. You see my arrow here, All we have in this little strip of blue here at this point here, this is European enslavement. The strip down here is colonization. But if I do like this, this is our historical continuum when we've been ourselves. I ain't no Hotepa. I'm not one of these guys walking around going like a hieroglyph. I'm trying to be practical to say that if you have no confidence in self, anybody else will beat you or whatever. You got to build that self-confidence, build that self-knowledge. And as Jesus said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. I might also say worship the Lord thy God, but that might be controversial. Thank you very much. Sorry, gone on 30 seconds over.
No, it's okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for that just incredibly thought-provoking presentation. As you were speaking, I was just constantly reminded of Du Bois' concept of double consciousness and the ways in which Black folks have internalized a sense of inferiority, and the way that that has affects and structures the way that we move through space and the way that we even conceive of ourselves, what our potential is, and, you know, what we're capable of achieving in the world. And maybe a question that I'll return to in our final sort of question and answer period at the end of the class or at the end of our session is, so you mentioned at one point, you know, the woman who introduces herself as the quote unquote bubbly Black woman and feeling the need to modify her Blackness or to make it digestible or respectable. Palatable, exactly for others in the workplace or just for a stranger that she's meeting. And so I can definitely see and understand how changing how we view ourselves and coming to be more confident and really celebrating ourselves and our history can change our interactions with the workplace and with others in the workplace. But I guess the only limitation is we cannot really control how we will be perceived by others. No matter what we think, we will always be seen first and foremost, as you said, as Black. So how do we surmount that? And how do we surmount the challenge to uphold respectability politics, to be the quote unquote right type of Black person in the workplace?
Number one, you see there are certain circumstances where people say, for instance, if you had a paramedic and there's an accident, unless they're a real card-carrying racist, they won't mind who saves their life. They won't mind who saves their child's life. There are certain things where your professional status transcends any circumstance that you're in. So for instance, I've been in many contexts, professional contexts, where you're the only person of color that's there. So one of the things I've learned is that I must feel, because I've taken prejudice from Black people as well as white people. You're too light. I got told the other week, last year, I was too light-skinned to suffer from racism. And this is from like a 27-year-old youngster. And so I said, man, it's a pity you can't time travel, come back and tell the boneheads in Blackburn I was fighting knuckle to knuckle, right, that I was too light to be persecuted. You know, take you instead. What it's about is how you feel about yourself. When you go in there, you see, if you're going in there half-hearted, and let me say this to you, I've worked in prisons for over 30 years now, and I've had to use many things. I'm a martial artist, 45 years I've been instructing, and because of things like this, you understand about the way we move. There's an old Beatles track called Something, Something in the Way She Moves Attracts Me Like No Other Lover. So something in somebody's way, their attitude. The word attitude means physical position proper to implying a mental state. So the way you hold yourself, if you're going in there expecting trouble, it'll come to you, because you'll give a vibration out to people that they will pick up. If they are racist, if they are exclusive, if they are the one you can't do anything about that, but you've got to be there for yourself. So no matter what anybody does, like Du Bois calling it double consciousness. I work with that every day. I live with that every day. We all do. If you're of color from another culture, you're in this culture, we've all got double consciousness. So it's how we nurture that and how we feel about ourselves. One thing that's for certain, all that's happening now, Black Lives Matter, one of the key things that's happening, we are being reminded again of our oppression. It's going over and over and over again. You were slaves, you were slaves, you were this, you were that. So for me, I say to people, yes, slavery is a very small part of our historical continuum, but it's glorified because you're telling people that these people, yeah, you slaved us, you empowered us. Now, there's a song called Rule Britannia. I'm sure you heard that when you were in Cambridge. So what happens is that song was actually written by a guy called Thomas Owen around about 1761. The reasons they were saying Britons, 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 never, never, never shall be slaves is because they were hitting on the North African Empire. They were getting enslaved by the Moors and the Turks. They don't want to tell you those kind of stories. It's there in Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. If you look at the story, it's actually in there. White people were getting enslaved by the Arabs and by the Moors. So what was happening, they, in their psychology, have to give this, they develop this this overwhelming narcissism that nothing else went on in the world before Europe did it. It's absolutely ridiculous. It does not give a sense of continuum, historical continuum of humanity. We get taught bits and bats and whatever. So the more we learn, we contextualize it, we draw down on it. Don't get angry about it. These are circumstances. People done bad things to bad people. But you must remember that this last enslavement is still with us today, but we've got to move past it. It's our duty to be, not ask European people who did it. You don't, rape victims do not ask the rapist to heal them. Does that make sense? They don't ask the rapist to heal. They go have to seek and find out how to heal themselves. And the healing part is what we've not gone through. So we can talk about, what I say, agenda A, agenda B. I know some brilliant, brilliant scholars, activists and whatever. Their personal lives are a mess. I know about business people who are millionaires. You know, they've got access to everything they want. Their personal lives are a mess. We need healing. And that's the stage that we have to get to. So the double consciousness can work for us. We have to switch it on and switch it off.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that response. Now we're going to turn our session over to Mr. Paul Davidson. And Paul, just let me know whenever you want me to pull up the website, and I will open that for you and share it to everyone that's here.
Great. Thank you so much, Aisha. And thank you, Paul. I'm really glad that we did do the switch over, because I thought, you know, I could have listened to you all morning. I think you could have taken the whole session. I'm always fascinated by our ability to understand our journey, because unless we understand our journey, it's very difficult to plan the way ahead. And I've not gone through an academic journey in my life. I've gone through a very practical stage in life. So I was the sort of person who would have been more in the technical college rather than the corridors of university. In fact, if I make a confession, I had a very hands-on journey through life and went straight from school into employment. And so I've never attained the kind of academic background that often we speak about. But I'm a real and avid supporter of academia, and all my children, of course, have booked the trend with me, and they've all done what they've needed to do. But I've always asked big questions in life about where we are, what's our standing in life. And I've been influenced by the Christian element of my upbringing, and so I do have very strong values which I have collected through my time in church and in my time in exploring the message of the Christian gospel. And I'm not purporting that that's what this is about, but that's how I have been cultured, if you like, and I've gained a lot of my values from there, and they still stay with me. I think of many of those values are absolutely awesome, so I don't apologize for them, even though people may have a historical context as to how we came about this kind of information. But I was really impressed with the issues about the five C's there, Paul, the double consciousness. I thought that was quite a fascinating thing. So I'm like a sponge, you see, I like to pick up on things and learn and improve my understanding, even though I'm a hands-on person. So hands-on that in my journey in employment, I went straight into professional employment, and I've always felt a little bit like an imposter because I keep doors keep opening in front of me, which I haven't qualified for them to open. I can't see what did I do to achieve these things which are happening around me. People tell me that at the moment I have the biggest black business in Manchester, and yet I employ so many people who have got a university background, and I've always done so. In the 80s, I opened my first company as a cake-making business, and within 7 months, we were nationally famous, having made Prince William's first birthday cake, then becoming Manchester United's official cake maker when they produced the cake for the FA Cup finals. I am not a Red Bull.
Oh!
but I enjoyed getting the accolade of doing that. Since then, I've worked in economic development in a whole range of organizations, been a director of many companies, and been aware of the lack of participation of Black people in business ownership and economic development. Manchester is the fastest growing city in Europe at the moment. And I'm participating in so many forums where I feel the disappointment of not seeing any of my own comrades sat around many of these tables. Whenever a big building is being built, that's going to cost £50 million. I know that the Jewish and the Asian and the Americans and Russians are all there, but I just can't find the people of African descent sat around those tables building anything of significance. Okay, there are business people in the small business sector, but even that is very, very low in its representation. So I've been determined for many years to ask the question. I don't say I start with an answer, but with a question, why are we not there? And many people give me all kinds of reasons about, you know, why we're excluded. But when I've really dug really deep, I've realized, no, you can be included around this table if you have a ticket. And I thought, well, where do you get the ticket from? And what is the ticket? And the ticket has nothing to do with who you are, but it has to do with the £10 million that you have to bring to the table. And somehow that's elusive in our community. Where do Black people get £10 million from to sit at the table to build a skyscraper? And of course, one of the clues I realized was that actually you might find 10 million Black people. Ask that 10 million Black people where they can get £10 million from and see if they can work it out. You know, although that I'm being simplistic, some years ago I began an organization to try to put together a coming together. And we always say it, don't we, as Black people, we need to come together. And that's what I've dedicated my life to doing, to trying to say to people, let's get on with it. Sometimes you get a lot of flack and people think you're a charlatan, you just want to, you know, run a scheme or do something. And I've had a lot of criticism in the public, and you have to overcome that and keep going because you believe in what you believe. In my day job, I run a residential business. We employ around 50 staff. We turn over just less than £2 million a year, and we're growing constantly. We're a model of best practice in our sector. But we are very much about doing something about it. So that's why we're called Taif Desai. And right now, I'll just ask for the slide to be put up, which will just give you a snapshot of our website. And then I want to just give you a brief summary of what it is that we're actually doing. So our company is called Taif Desai. That's the strange word. You can see there, TYFDSAI. Now, that's an acronym for the words underneath it. Thank you for doing something about it. What I'm saying in this organization here is that many of our heroes have been telling us for years, you've got to do something about it. And it's interesting what you also said, Paul, in that you know, we can't continue to be victims of the past. We have to do something about our current situation. And so what I've done is I've asked people if they'd like to do something about it. What if we could get 1 million people in Britain to put just £2 per week on the table as a form of commitment, as a kind of taxation, if you like, that we can have to address many of the issues in our society? If 1 million people put £2 a week on the table, that's £2 million. Could you do something with £2 million, especially if you're having it every week? And of course you could. And the problem we have is, could it really be done? And you can see the picture of Mandela there saying, it always seems impossible until it's done. I've always wondered about some of the things I mentioned earlier, feeling like an imposter. When Mandela was invited by the Queen to Britain, I don't understand why I was given a ticket to be in the reception. I was sat in the third row in the Barbican Centre in London at this amazing event. And I've been inspired so much by what is happening. So the last year and a half, we've been developing this organization. So I'm just going to go back down a little bit and see if the video that you're, I wonder, will it play if you clicked on that video? Great.
Ghetto humanitarian aid and charity. In major cities around the world, we see hotels being built, large office buildings going up, fancy apartment blocks, commercial premises, new cruise ships and airlines. Black people watch as others build and take ownership. The Chinese, the Jews, the Asians, the European and the white Americans, they're all building. And we are watching. But what are they building with? They're building with their money and their labor. But they're also building with your money and labor. So what would happen if you kept back some of your money and labor to build something for yourself? What would happen if you kept back some of your money and labor to own something for yourself? The African Diaspora Finance Initiative is the answer. We're building the largest voluntary fund in the history of the world, made up of millions of people who are ready to make a difference. And we need you to join us today to contribute £2 per week and to introduce two other people to join us. We need you to get involved now. We aim to have 20 million participants contributing just £2 per week, creating a fund that will be receiving £40 million every week. Can you imagine what we will do with that? The number of jobs we will create? The number of people we will lift out of poverty? The number of hotels, office buildings, and factories we will own? Will you help us to make it happen?
Thank you, Aisha. So hopefully, everyone can hear me again. So hopefully that summarizes, because I want to be simple here, because TIFDSI is not a complex organization. We're really saying that, yeah, just give me a signal, Aisha, are you hearing okay? Yes, okay.
Yes.
Great, super. We're really saying that Black lives will never matter as long as the Black pound and dollar is facing the wrong direction. Black people are amongst the biggest consumers in the world. We're spending trillions, literally, on consumables, but we're spending it outside of our own community. And much of the respect that we don't get is simply because we haven't got our own act together. I know this is controversial, but we have to recognize the economic power we have and marshal it. It's not sufficient to wait for somebody to fix things for us. And so what we're doing in TIFDSI, we're a little bit frightened because thousands of people are preparing to join. Tomorrow morning we have a workshop where our social media team begins to explode, and meet a whole range of influencers who are joining us. Our company's chaired back from Canada, and we're looking at building chapters all over the world. Chapters that we call G50 groups. So wherever Black people live in large numbers, we want to establish a G50 group. That's up to 50 people.
I think it appears we momentarily lost Mr. Davidson. I'm going to see if I can contact him to get him back into the session. Until then, in the meantime, if anyone who's newly joined our group or session wants to pose any questions to the group, please send them in the chat. Let's see. And let's see here. Okay. in the meantime, I think we could just sort of begin to open up a discussion on so much of what Mr. Davidson was speaking about, and the idea of crowdfunding and using Black capital to begin to create and expand Black businesses, to make sure that Black people actually have a seat at the table and are the ones making those decisions that are often made at the corporate level, you know, in rooms that we're often excluded from. Something that I'm thinking about is how, in the long run, you know, what course will this work take, and how can an increasing number of Black businesses help, like, the average Black person as well, right? So also acknowledging the fact that we live within a capitalist society, and how can average people, you know, see their wealth multiply or sort of maintain and enjoy a piece of the pie from which they're often excluded from, because we not only live, you know, in a society that is racist, but also one that is classed as well. I don't know, Mr. Urbina, if you have any thoughts on Mr. Davidson's presentation so far.
I loved it. I noticed Paul's back. Paul is back.
Oh, I didn't even see.
He snuck in.
Paul, I just asked you to unmute yourself. Can you?
Yes, yes.
Yep.
Right. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Sorry. And I did pick up, Asia, on your point, the question that you were posing, which is brings to the heart of what TIFE Desai is about. We believe that the current capitalist system is not designed for us. And to play at the capital system in the same way is going to leave us disadvantaged. So even in our organization, we've created a scheme we call advantage points. We have to give each other advantages. So for instance, first of all, the organization is a not-for-profit company limited by guarantee with no shareholders, because we're planning to control tens of millions of pounds per week. And we don't want it to be owned by an individual or a select group of people. It must belong to us as a community in its widest sense. However, the small businesses, our primary aim is not profit, even though we're going to be aggressively profit making. But the aim isn't so that somebody makes profits so they can buy an island or buy a Lamborghini. The aim is job creation. We want to create as many jobs where Black people have got middle class incomes earning 30,000 to 60,000 pounds per year. That's what we want to be measured by, the number of people who elevate themselves. We have two policies, a minimum wage policy. So we don't believe people should work for peanuts, not when you've worked hard to prepare yourself for life. But conversely, we also have another policy called a maximum wage policy. So we say sadly to people who are seeking to just personally enrich themselves that the maximum wage will be set at around £100,000 per year. And it doesn't matter how special you think you are, that you have to, if you work for us, employed, whether you can be the chairman, I'm the governor of the organization, I'm a volunteer, we have employed four staff and I have opened an office, but fortunately my other company is able to meet all my financial needs. So there's no need for me to be paid. This is more than getting money. This is about a statement that Black people have to get together. And what we have lacked in the past is benevolent leadership. So we have lots of leaders, but not benevolent leaders. What I mean by that is people who want to really lead for the community, who really want to put to one side what they're going to get out of it and realize this is really about what we get out of it. It's not about me, it's got to be about we. So we're passionate that we must get the values right. And so therefore we've opened the organization up so that when people join, they have a say, their voice matters. Even in finance, once someone's a member, they have a membership number and have access to the Goldfish Bowl auditing system. We must not have a secret in the organization to our members about what's happening or how things are moving. We also have a policy of plurality, so that we don't want power or anything polarized in the hands of any one person. So from top to bottom, but there's a discussion happening at the moment. What we're saying, let's give the organization back to the people. So that's why we have these G50 chapters, because people need to benefit immediately or in the short term. They need to see that supermarket being built in their area. of a significant place of trade that they can walk into and say, we own that. So what the G50 group will do is we're asking, because we all put £2 a week in. So there's two ways to invest in Time to Decide. One is the £2 a week, which we say is a general investment, which is a tax, so you don't get a return for that. And we say, if you want a return in life, don't expect it from £2 a week. But people will be able to invest between £100 and £1,000 in the actual local business themselves and get a return from that. But everything, there is a measure to, because we don't want there to be a power vacuum where one person, not only about power, what if something happens to a key individual and they're not able to function? So most all key roles have to have a triple lock where there's three people who occupy those roles. So our head of finance can't be the only person that makes financial decisions. We have a wonderful chair. He lives in Canada, and all our board meetings and our strategic meetings are chaired from Canada. And our board, in fact, our head of technical support, he's also the head of technical support for a major international corporation with responsibilities for the whole of Europe and the Middle East. And so we've tried to work hard to get what we were describing as a world-class leadership team. But is the team built yet? No, it isn't. It's only partially built. And what we've said as well in our philosophy is we must be ready to work with people who are much greater than we are without feeling threatened. We've got to be an organization that's welcoming all our folks and say, listen, okay, because we are great. I'm not saying let's create some sort of false humility. I was hosting Kenneth Kaunda, the former president of Zambia, on a visit to Manchester a good number of years ago. And in the high school that Paul will know, Juicy High School, he was allowed to meet some of the students, who six of them were allowed to meet this former president. And they were allowed to put a question to him. And they asked him questions about Zambia and his role as president and that. And one young boy said to him, Your Excellency, being a president for 26 years, are you proud of yourself? And of course, we all went quiet, thinking that's an awkward question to ask an individual. But he turned around in a stately manner and looked at the young man and said, Young man, God has done a good job of making all people. So we should all be proud of the job that God has done, whether he asks us to do anything great or small. So of course, I'm proud of the job that God has done. So he was able to communicate something to this young man. You should be proud, of what you're going to be. And I think that in our community, we have a lot of really great people, but we have to also develop a culture of celebrating each other's greatness, and being really comfortable with it. Because there's some amazing people that I meet in my life and I get very excited about them. We're now seeking to go into some sort of relationship with, the Martin Luther King Center in the United States. We're looking to reconnect with the Mandela Institute. We want to celebrate these people who have done so much for us. I can't wait till we really get into a position where we turn to someone like Oprah Winfrey and say, look, you are really a hero for Black people, for whatever you've achieved. Then people may have their own views, but we want to start to celebrate our heroes and allow them to give us a degree of leadership. So that's a little bit about our philosophy. But at the end of the day, we're a simple company. We do four things. On the back of our business card, it sets out our mission. It's four, and I'll finish with this. Our first mission is to come together. We want to find a way that stops us making the excuses and finding all the reasons why we shouldn't come together. The second thing we want to do is to develop a strategy for us to stay together. And that's where some of the psychology that you've talked about before, especially when you've talked about the double consciousness. I really want to look a little bit further into that, because as I said to you before, I'm not an academic, I'm an entrepreneur, but I want to learn as well about how to think the best the way we can. And so that's why I know we actually need each other. I've been given a gift to make money, and I'm thankful to that. But I take a salary. I don't even have a link to my company's profits. I'm just not interested. I think it's a sad way to live, just to want to get more and more and more. I think there are greater things to live for than just having more money, you know. But anyway, that's another story. So coming together, staying together is the next challenge, because what happens when we come together, I may make a mistake. I may make a decision that you don't agree with. And your reaction might be, well, I don't want to work with him anymore because I didn't agree. I'm thinking, wait a minute, hold on. We have to develop a psychological strategy to overcome the problems which we're definitely going to have. So we have people in our team. In fact, they nicknamed me the Director of Harmony, because if you fall out, we're going to have to do some work on that and see if we can get over it. If you make a mistake, I want to know what's our strategy to work with you. And it can't be that we just get rid of you or leave you on the side. We've got to be able to recover. So this sense of, you know, so that's the second thing, staying together. The third one is support each other. So one young lady who's joined our organization, she runs a business exhibition organization, and we want to run business exhibitions. So we've said, okay, well, now we know you do that, why don't we just contract you, you know, and support your organization? We'll just give you the funding that we have instead of, and let's big you up. And there's a lot of business networks out there that we know we're going to come into contact with. And they'll say, we're already doing something like that. And we'll say, well, great. Can we do what we're doing then through you? You know, can we, where's our collaboration? We must support each other. On the supporting of each other, we've developed some systems that are going to help people who produce things in the black economy to be really amazed at how they're going to get orders. I'll give you one example. One lady imports bottled water. And we created something called the Standing Order Shopping Program, where many of us are now giving her a standing order for a dozen bottles of water every week. So she's now getting hundreds of people saying, you don't have to buy the water and wonder if it's going to be sold. We need to give you an advantage. You can't just go and open a shop and keep your fingers crossed. When you open the shop, if you're a member of this organization, you're going to have X number of hundreds of people sign up a standing order. And where, of course, they get a benefit too, because the bottles of water, for argument's sake, are a pound each. It's an example. But if you have a standing order, you get them for 95p. So you get 5p off, but you've ordered for the whole year. And this woman now knows she can order a container shipped to her rather than going to the cash and carry and competing on an unfair system. So we're developing systems to lead to... We also have some strict principles about how we manage each other when they grow. And the fourth thing is come together, stay together, support each other, and then the final one is achieve together. And the one thing we want to achieve, we want to be really clear, is the building of this fund. Because sometimes, especially when we're an achieved person, we think £2, there must be something more important for me to do than just put £2 in. But we say to even our sports professionals who want to put £1 million in, what we're saying, I'm sorry, there isn't a facility for that right now. There is a facility for you to put £2 in though, because we want this to be owned by us collectively. No. So that's a nutshell about what we're involved in. As you can appreciate, it's a year and a half we've been consulting and building the structures. So I just wanted to give you a bit of a synopsis. When somebody wants to run a G50 chapter, they get a manual, they get training, they get support, etc., to be able to do that. And I'm really saying, let's ride on this current situation. The world knows that black people have to do something about it. I'm saying that we're not adequate. We don't have all of the answers. And our campaign really is to say to people, join with us. Let's get down on it and do this one thing. We're not saying it's the answer to everything, but certainly if we had a fund that had £40 million a week available and that we didn't have to go through a grant system or go through a financial institution to claim, you know, what difference would that make to us as black people? And that's our offering to the community today from a business point of view, job creation and wealth creation. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Mr. Davidson. And again, thank you so much, Mr. Rubinas. I think we're running a little bit short on time, so I'm just going to pose some questions for us to consider in the main session as well. So one of the pressing questions that's, I think, on everyone's mind is, you know, the immediacy of the threat of COVID-19, particularly those who maybe are recently unemployed, have been laid off from their jobs, and now no longer have a means of making an income or obtaining an income. What steps can we take both as individuals, as a community, and what can we demand of the state? And, you know, what can we look to in terms of laws to help protect members of the Black community and members of the Black British community? So that'll be something to think about in the next session as well. Thank you so really. It's just I could honestly listen to the two of you speak for ages. So thank you so much for sharing so much of your wisdom with us this morning or this afternoon, depending on what time zone you're in here. And lastly, I just invite everyone to return to the final plenary session. I'm going to be posting a link to that here to return to the main conference. Also, if there are any additional questions that you'd like me to bring up in the final session, please let me know and I will be happy to share or voice them. Great.
Okay.
Great. So as you all sort of see fit, you can leave this current session and head back to the main session and I'll be joining you all there shortly. Thank you so much.